Welcome. And welcome back to myself. I feel like I've been gone a couple weeks. I was back for one Wednesday night. And then I was gone again. It's very nice to come back to Santa Cruz and to the Sangha. I was away on a couple different Dharma retreats, and so since they're fresh right now, I may bring them up a little bit, some of these teachings. These were Tibetan Dzogchen teachings. As some of you know, this is my secret closet life. As a Dzogchen aspiring practitioner, and with some teachers that I really resonate with a lot. And I feel like this Soto Zen is, of course, my core root tradition, and these teachings, I feel like, help inform my Zen practice a lot, and in my role, I like to express through the lens of Zen language and tradition. But because I've been so immersed in these retreats, this may sound like it's kind of coming from these other traditions a little bit tonight. So I think there's great benefit in this kind of cross-fertilization that we have the opportunity to explore in America with all these different traditions of Buddhism and other spiritual practices. One of these Dzogchen retreats was with Choki Nima Rinpoche, and one was with Sokni Rinpoche, two brothers, blood brothers. Dzogchen means great perfection or great completion, and in my limited understanding, it looks to me like this is the same practice as Soto Zen, particularly Shikan Taza. But this Tibetan tradition has a really wonderful way of clarifying very precisely what we mean by just sitting. And I have a deep heart connection with these teachers. I've done several retreats with. Of course, in Zen we have our teachers. So, root teacher in Zen. We have this term root teacher, Honshi, and strictly speaking, it means that the teacher that you receive Dharma from, that who transmits Dharma to you. And so, your root teacher can never change once that relationship is sealed. And Tibetan tradition, they also have this term root teacher, which is the first teacher who points out the nature of your mind to you in a way that you get it, in a way that transforms you. So maybe strictly speaking, that would never change either, because it's the first. But then some teachers in that tradition say they have like 25 root teachers. So anything's possible, right? But Sokni Rinpoche in particular, I feel like is my, I consider a root Vajrayana teacher. Tenshin Roshi being my root Zen teacher. I think it's wonderful to practice with different teachers and open that heart connection, and learn, of course, too, from them. But just being around great beings is such an inspiration. So this retreat with Sokni Rinpoche was in Crestone, Colorado. Has anyone been to Crestone? I just feel compelled to just briefly just tell you about this town. if you ever go. I recommend checking it out if you're out that way. It's pretty remote. You know, it's like a 4-hour drive from Denver being the nearest town into just complete remote wilderness desert, basically. Desert along the edge of the Sangre de Cristo mountains, big mountains. The desert itself is, I think, 9,000 feet. So the mountains are way up above that. And this tiny town of Crestone is this basically like a spiritual village. An amazing bodhisattva woman whose name is escaping me, had this huge property the size of a small village and had this vision of let's make a spiritual community open to everyone of all traditions. And so she, because she had this land, she could do that. So she basically gave away the land to anyone who wanted it. So there's about probably 20 or maybe more than 20 different spiritual communities that took her up on that offer, that kind offer. Each one having acres of wild, small forest land on the edges of these steep mountains. So most of them are Tibetan, maybe because the Tibetans felt like this looks like Tibet to us. This barren plain with steep mountains. There must be over 10 Tibetan centers of all different traditions. Two different Zen centers, both in Suzuki Roshi's lineage. One is Baker Roshi's, beautiful mountain center. Maybe no Vipassana center that I know of, but at least one Christian monastery, a Hindu ashram, a Sufi community, and more. So it's really interfaith. They're all along this one road. Every few hundred yards is another sign for another community. You can't quite see them because they're back in the trees. So it's a wonderful place. That's the kind of the people who live there are almost all some kind of practitioners. I've moved there for that reason. So this particular retreat was on the theme of integrating Dzogchen, great perfection, Zen teachings of clear, open, non-dual awareness that is the full manifestation of Buddha nature, that the potential we all have to be completely free and clear and awake and at ease. Those teachings integrated with practicing with what we call the subtle body, the channels and winds of not quite the mind, not quite the gross body as we think of it. And so not really about non-dual meditation, but very important in that tradition, this integration of settling the subtle body in order to open this clear awareness. So tonight I'd like to talk a little bit about this subtle body. I think I've brought it up here in the past maybe too. We don't talk about it so much in Zen tradition, but it's there. And so I brought some Zen references. I think of a particular Zen origin dealing with this kind of practice is Bodhidharma, our great first ancestor in China who brought Zen from India to China. It's so long ago, that was the 5th or 6th century, that it's kind of lost in the mists of legend who was Bodhidharma. But Shaolin Temple, that we know is the place he founded in China, is now this huge center for martial arts in China. I visited, and there is, of course, a Buddha hall and a Zendo, but they're just full of spider webs and collecting dust. But hundreds, maybe thousands of people running around doing all these martial arts moves. In fact, the whole town around Shaolin is for lots of kids learning on martial arts camp. And they make a lot of movies, a lot of the kung fu movies are at Shaolin Temple. But that's Bodhidharma's place. So, as the legend has it, he was this integrator of Zazen. That was his main thing. He transmitted Zazen from India to China. He's our ancestor. But also transmitted these ways of working with subtle energy. I think, as I understand it, to support Zazen and enhance Zazen practice. And later they became their own thing of martial arts. So in the Vajrayana tradition, these teachings are not actually from Tibet, they're from India. This is Indian yoga that the Tibetans took on really directly. Maybe Chinese Zen didn't really take on the Indian yoga part so directly. Particularly like pranayama, maybe kundalini yoga. And of course they use their own terms in Tibetan tradition. They developed their own way of talking about it, but it's based on these Indian systems of energy work. So we have the channels, in Sanskrit, nadi, or, you know, meridians or pathways. Now, trying to integrate all these systems, maybe we don't want to do this tonight, but I think there's correlation between the Indian model and the Chinese model that is used in acupuncture and all kinds of qigong. Mapping the meridians exactly may be hard, but one focus in all these traditions is the main channel just in front of the spine. And I think this is one of the main reasons why we emphasize in Zazen posture, the main thing, whatever you do with your legs, make them comfortable. There's different possibilities with your hands, but the main postural point is a straight spine. It's partly because it's more comfortable over a long time, but I would understand it as a big part of the straight spine is the flow of prana, or energy, chi, that affects the gross body and affects the mind. The subtle body is kind of this connecting link between the mind and what we think of as the physical body. These channels through which this energy or wind moves. And then there's chakras, maybe is an extra little thing that could be brought in there too. But the main thing to work with is these channels and the winds that flow through them. Tibetan tradition also has it. They call bindu or drops that are like Sokhmu Rinpoche talks about as in like modern scientific terms as kind of like neurotransmitters. So there may be some connection in the ancient Indian system between these drops are maybe like like things like serotonin and adrenaline. There may be chemical molecules. We don't know what the Indians thought here, but they don't talk in those terms, but Sogni Rinpoche thinks maybe that's what they're about. They flow through the body and they affect our moods and feelings. So the way that this subtle body is presented, at least by this teacher, Sokhmu Rinpoche, is that it's the way we experience it as feelings, actually, like emotions. The subtle body is the basis of emotions. And you know, if we're coming from a strictly mind point of view, we might say that, well, like Abhidharma in Buddhism would say, well, all emotions are different combinations of these different 51 mental factors. It's all just mind stuff. And also from a strictly Dzogchen point of view, it would usually be said that all our experience is based on mind. It's closely related to the mind-only tradition, which a lot of us have been studying. But from the point of view of this yogic subtle body energy work, we could say all our experience comes from this, from the workings of these channels and winds, actually. So are those contradictory? Is it coming from the mind or from the subtle body? Maybe not contradictory. Maybe actually just two different ways of looking at the same thing, and they can be integrated. And this retreat was about integrating. And I think it's a really important teaching in Zen practice, or just in practice in America, in the modern world, in busy life, and for people living in, working full-time in the world, living outside of monasteries and so on. I think these practices are really great because we have such a speedy culture, and our speedy culture, like doing everything quickly, having deadlines, rushing, getting stressed, this is a really common experience in our culture. And these are the things that that tighten up the subtle body. We might say they affect our mind, but I think to look at it from the point of view of subtle body could be really helpful. That so we have the channels. They're not physical. Remember, these are like subtle. They're not quite mental. They're not quite physical, but they're invisible energy pathways. But the way of talking about it is that really stressful experiences, like basically tie up those channels in knots. And there's some natural knots around where the chakras are, but there's unnatural knots that particularly like traumatic experiences will like kink or, you know, tie up these channels. These are just images for what's happening here. And when they're kinked, it's like take a garden hose with a lot of water energy flowing through it, and if you kink it, everything gets tight, the hose starts getting really, feels like it's gonna burst. It's not a healthy situation, right? It's blocked, it's blockage. So there's practice to basically straighten out the channels that have been, due to like ancient twisted karma, have been like knotted up and kinked. And then the other thing that can happen besides the channels being knotted and kinked is the energy that flows through them, even if the channels are not blocked, the energy can start moving erratically and in a blocked way. The energy can just get stuck. The chi is not moving, and or the chi or winds start getting too high up in the upper channels. I think we can feel some of these things, right? And particularly, like, this is not so much from traumatic experience and karmic patterns being enacted over and over. This is just like a moment-to-moment thing in our day-to-day lives. If we're, like, talking a lot, thinking a lot, maybe just, you know, working at the computer with a bad posture, and it really, like, in our head, as we say, very conceptual, and rushing a lot. This brings all the winds like to the upper body, even if the channels might be not so blocked. So we have these two different problems, and both of them can be helped by basically like bringing the wind and energy like down. And for people who know Qigong, maybe some types of yoga too, this is one of the main things, is you bring the bring the chi down, particularly to the Indian and Tibetan traditions call it like the navel chakra. The Chinese tradition calls the elixir field dantian, or in Japanese the tanden. In both traditions, is exactly the same place for finger width, 2 inches below the belly button. And it's right where our little fingers meet the abdomen when we're having this, holding this Dharma Dhatu Samadhi Mudra, the cosmic hand position. If the thumbs are about the belly button level, they're a little bit out, but the little fingers touch right at that spot. And the, as I understand it, that Dan Tian is not right there on the skin, but it's more like back by this central channel in front of the spine. But this is the place, and we can, just by touching it there, that contact starts to bring our attention down there more. The mind affects the energy. The subtle body, a very close connection between the subtle body and the gross body, because when all the wind is up here, the gross body feels exhausted. This is the dilemma of modern life. It feels stressed, exhausted, tired, or exhausted and we can't sleep at the same time. This is like a wind problem. So, rather than sleeping pills or whatever, there's these exercises and zazen, this particular type of looking at zazen can really help sleep well, feel fresh, not need as much sleep, stay healthy, have bright eyes, feel grounded on the earth, and feel like basically happy for no reason. That's one of Sogyal Rinpoche's phrases. We have to learn to be happy for no reason. You could say, well, maybe this is a reason. It's the subtle body is all functioning well. But that's just like not exactly a reason. It's just the way the body's working. So the subtle body affects the gross body in those ways, and it affects the mind also in terms of stress and so on, and vice versa. If we're working really hard with the gross body, doing a lot of physical hard work, that also like wears out, kind of like can exhaust the subtle body too. We need to rejuvenate our chi if we're like doing too much physical labor. And the mind can affect the subtle body as well as vice versa. There's the classic phrase that goes back to India is, the mind rides the winds or the energy like a rider on a horse, or even more particularly a lame rider riding a blind horse. So the mind is kind of like this rider, very intelligent rider, very knows exactly how everything works. Heard all these emptiness teachings. We got it. Yeah, there's nothing really exists, but I still feel like totally stressed because that rider is very intelligent but lame. It means like can't quite walk right. You know, it's not quite embodied. And the horse that's like these winds that kind of sometimes wild horse that carries this intelligent but kind of crippled rider, the horse is blind. So if we just let those winds just go wherever they want, it's like this wild horse. It needs taming. So you combine those. You get the intelligent rider but whose legs don't work riding on this this horse and can show the horse where to go with its intelligence, then you have a really good combination for a smooth, fast ride. So this is an example of like you put your, this is actually all three. You put your physical fingers on the lower abdomen over this navel chakra, over this field of elixir. And then rest your attention there. The mental attention naturally goes there. When you first touch it, your mind kind of naturally goes there, but then you can keep. If you keep that little contact place is like a focus for the mind's attention. So Dogen's teacher in China, Tiantong Lujing, in his little like excerpts on, you know, the special oral transmissions of Zazen to Dogen, he said, rest your mind in the palms of your hands when you sit Zazen, and when your hands are like this, which is kind of like that. Rest your mind means like let your mental attention, let the mind's attention rest in this physical location that then connects with this field of elixir, this Dantian, that is the home of the winds. Like when the winds or energy move around through the upper body, I mean, they circulate through the whole body, but their resting place where they're all kind of like ideally emanating from and circulating from is this Dantian. So we, with the mind, the body, and the subtle body, we can let the winds settle back in to this lower abdomen in Zazen. And breath is also very connected to winds. It's not exactly the same, although sometimes, like in Chinese, the word, the character for qi, it's the same as this Indian prana, or Tibetan lung, is that qi character also is used to translate breath. So in China, sometimes it's like no distinction at all. But they're closely related. I would say not exact. The physical breath is a part of the gross body, but it's closely correlated with these internal winds. So we can train the horse of the winds with the breath. And the main way is just breathing in the lower abdomen and breathing deeply. And so a lot of you have heard that Zazen instruction probably. But we maybe forget it and we think that's not that important. Maybe we even count the breath, but we neglect to keep bringing the breath down low and deep. You know, our lungs are actually, you know, from here to here probably. So our lungs are not actually down here, but you can feel like you can breathe down here and your abdomen goes in and out. It kind of feels like you have a lung down there. That's really ideal. And I also think I've mentioned many times at the beginning of Zazen, I still try to do this almost every period. I feel so helpful, especially if kind of like rushing in and kind of stressed. First sit down, arrange the posture, get the central channel straight, and then take a few really deep breaths, like exhale fully, like so you just, you know, abdomen kind of caves in, and then breathe in really, really fully. And in some of these subtle body practices, this is the main thing too. You're breathing really deeply in the lower abdomen. And there's practices where you can hold the breath out to kind of let the winds settle more and more deeply there. I wouldn't suggest in a group Zazen you hold it really long in because you have to go, ah! And it's maybe not that. I think we want to have a comfortable, relaxed breathing. But you can hold it for just like a second or two, and then release it really fully. Three breaths, but you can also do it for lately, especially since this retreat. And before this retreat, I was getting interested in this. So taking like some of the period of Zazen, especially if I'm like the mind's really like not so settled, like minutes of or, you know, a section of the period to just do this kind of breathing. There's other types of breathing that are really good for the subtle body too, that more like imagining the circular breath going down even below this point, down to the very base of the spine, up the spine to the crown of the head, and then down the front, opens channels in a slightly different way. So and it really affects the body and the mind. And it's emotional, you know. That's the beginning, right? The subtle body is the source of emotions. So If we're sitting and we're like, yeah, I feel pretty relaxed, but there's this underlying dis-ease, or maybe we feel a little depressed, or just a little anxious, or some kind of emotional thing, even though our cognitive mind might be kind of clear, the emotional body is not at ease. This is particularly good for that, because it's really hard to settle the mind into this open awareness, letting all thought go without doing this. So it's almost like preliminary, especially if our emotional body feels blocked or out of balance. You know, put aside like the usual, this is a possibility, to put aside usual Zazen practice of just letting go of thought and kind of like work the energy a little bit. And then see if that makes a difference to settle down more. Yes?
The Japanese word shin is sometimes alternately translated as heart or mind. I've been told that it's actually heart-mind.
Yeah.
Would that be a reference to this?
Yeah. Well, heart kind of implies emotion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you could say that way that shin is both heart and mind is kind of like the union of our emotional life and cognitive life, which are a little different. And it's one event, really. We're just talking about it here as the thinking mind and the subtle body and the gross body is. I think, yeah.
So what I've been thinking about lately, thinking about the term Zen Shin, you know, which I'm kind of translating as wholehearted mind. There are parts of my practice where my mind wants to take a Polaroid and say, this is it. But there's a real resistance. There's a kind of energy that says, keep it all moving, keep it all moving. And there's a combination of things that are still and moving at the same time. Dynamic stillness kind of thing. And that's when I feel... That's where I feel like I'm near the flow, when I can't quite identify what is still and I can't quite identify what is moving. And it is an emotional experience.
Mm. Yeah, and probably a pretty positive emotional experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if great sorrows come up, it's very, I feel all that. There's a great... a sense of fullness and correctness about the adjustment.
Yeah, settled. We can feel settled. And also concentration is an aspect here too. The breath is always linked to that. An example is you might notice, this is just a natural way our body and system does this. If you're doing some really fine detail, maybe artwork or writing, you're really focusing and you don't want your hand to, you know, go, you want to keep your hand really steady, you might notice that you're holding your breath. You naturally kind of hold your breath, like stop breathing sometimes for a moment in order to steady your mind and body. So I think that's a way that like our system naturally knows these kinds of things without even hearing about them. We're holding the breath, and it's often feels like it's in my experience, it feels like it's in the lower abdomen, which is like gathering the energy down there in order to do this activity for a moment. This is a talk by a Japanese Soto Zen teacher named Man'an in the 6th century. In the lineage of Dogen, but he talks a lot about, kind of unusually so, talks about this energy as used in Zazen. He's giving basically Zazen instructions. He says, as we've heard many times, sit straight, neither leaning backward nor forward, aligning the ears with the shoulders and the nose with the navel. With the eyes open as normal, keep watch over the tip of your nose. Do not close your eyes, for that will beckon oblivion and drowsiness. rest your mind in the palm of your left hand. Or if you put your right hand on top, your right hand's fine. And have your energy fill your lower abdomen, waist and pelvic region and legs, expanding the ocean of energy in the umbilical sphere. So this is one of the terms they use. The ocean of energy is the ki kai. Ki is Japanese way of saying chi. So the ocean of chi in the umbilical sphere. Take one deep breath and expel it completely through the mouth. So sometimes they say the mouth. I think nose is also okay. Then close the lips and let fresh air enter through the nose in continuous subtle respiration, neither hurried nor sluggish. Be aware of the exit and entry of the breath. Being aware of the exit and entry of the breath, think of what is not thinking. So that's a nice combination of basically three different Zen instructions. One is like, settle your energy down in the like home of chi, in this ocean of chi that's that lower abdomen. And then being aware of the exit and entry of the breath, think of what's not thinking. So sometimes we say either your practice is being aware of the breath coming and going, or your practice is shikantaza, or think of what's not thinking. We usually make that distinction. I often think of that as two different practices. But here's kind of combining them. While you're being aware of the breath going in and out, you're also thinking of not thinking. If you concentrate intently, basic energy will naturally fill you and solidify you. Your lower abdomen will become like a gourd or a ball. As for the method of tuning the breathing, after having settled in your seat, nurture your mental energy in the ocean of energy and field of elixir. So the ki kai and the tanden, which I think Chinese tradition says are like, you know, about an inch apart, or they're both in the same area, basically. Not letting it push upward from the umbilical sphere. Breathe through the nose, neither too rapidly nor too slowly, neither panting nor puffing. And so on. When this concentration becomes continuous, the physical elements of the body become well-tuned, the internal organs are purified, the upper parts are clear and cool, while the lower parts are warm. Body and mind will spontaneously produce great joyfulness. In the Vajrayana tradition, when they get into the more advanced breathing exercises, it's in the for the purpose of the realization of the union of bliss and emptiness. We always have to have the empty element in here, so we don't get caught up in bliss, but emptiness, kind of stagnant, dull emptiness. Isn't the full extent of the circulation of Buddha nature. Yes?
I had a wonderful yoga teacher some years ago who taught us certain breathing exercises in the restorative phase of the yoga class. And I just remembered one as he was speaking. We were to breathe through our backs as if we were fish and had gills. Which we were able to do, and it brought not only relaxation but a kind of happiness to me. Now, I was wondering if some of these advanced practices that you mentioned will help us to go to that somewhat neglected area,
the back, and actually the whole body. We have to bring our, you know, whole bodily experience into this practice, gross body and subtle body. But I think that's a common experience in various kinds of yoga and breathing. You come, like, I hardly ever go to yoga classes, but partly because of that, maybe. When I do go for like a whole half hour or an hour, I come out in like a different world. Right? It's like, maybe if you get more used to it, it's not so dramatic, but it's, wow, it really changes your whole experience. And your point about being able to breathe through the back like gills, I think that's a good example of how the mind, we hear that with the mind, and it's like an imagination, a visualization of like, well, let's imagine having gills and how that is. The mind's visualization creates an experience, an actual experience. It's amazing, actually, that the mind affects the physical and particularly the subtle body. And, you know, being amidst all these Vajrayana teachings the past couple of weeks in that tradition, this visualization, which is a mental thing, is a huge part of the practice. You're constantly visualizing yourself and other beings as kind of like different things than you usually appear, in order to as a kind of just skillful means. It's not an ultimate realization, but it's as a skillful means to open to this what's called pure perception. Pure perception being like, basically like experiencing this mundane, stressed out, messed up world as like a totally purified Buddha land, and all of us are fully functioning Buddhas. I think we have those kind of teachings in Zen too. We just talk about, we don't imagine or visualize it so much, we just say all of us are Buddhas. Yes, and fish, and we can breathe through any part of our body. Yeah. Yes, Kathy.
Well, but I would say that, you know, for me, some of the things about Dogen that have been so helpful is that he does use metaphoric language, and even though we're not being asked to visualize it, he's writing about it,
yeah,
and the words go in,
yeah,
and it can be very helpful to just practice with some of that real, I think, very embodied, joy-oriented,
yeah,
physical imagery that he, yeah, uses.
Mm-hmm. Like the flipping and flapping of a fish.
Yeah. Like
awesome.
People, you know, being on the surface of the ocean and walking on the bottom of the ocean,
uh-huh,
is being time. I mean, that one teaching can sustain,
yeah,
one through a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I appreciate.
In fact, that's a great example of what we're talking about too, right? It's like, You can, if you're walking on the bottom of the ocean with your energy in the lower part of your body grounded down here, then you can like have a conversation up here and still stay grounded. I don't know if that's quite what you meant, but it's that integration of
absolutely
top and bottom.
That's what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a nice image. Yes.
So at the very beginning, you talked about Tibetan giving examples of Shikantaza more.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
Clearly,
yeah,
that's a word you use. But I wonder if this is a time you might say anything, or
thank you,
maybe another talk.
Somewhere. Yeah. Well, let me just, as a closing, let's do that, because this retreat was about, it was actually mostly about this Shikantaza, natural awareness, naked awareness, sometimes called, and we hear about that in our tradition more often, so I'm emphasizing the subtle body part tonight. But as a practice, we could try out some of these, especially if you feel stressed, worn down, ragged, and emotionally pushed, or whatever, in Zazen or outside of Zazen, you can try these practices. And then if you feel somewhat settled, then we have that integration part. That almost looks like a preliminary to getting really settled. And then I'll just bring up one example from this retreat that I thought was really helpful. We have it's a lot of the same language, like basically like drop. Just drop everything. Drop and open. Dzogchen tradition emphasizes openness a lot, and it's like mind, body, openness, drop and open. And I was engaging the Rinpoche a little bit about, yeah, what about this drop? And this was a nice example he gave. I'll pass on to you. He said, we talk about dropping thoughts, right? Letting go of thoughts. That's like, here's our mind, right? And here's like a thought, and you drop it, and then another thought comes, and you drop it, and another thought comes, and you drop it. And that's valuable practice. Maybe like, that's kind of a, basically like a shamatha mind calming thing. You drop it, and then you drop the next one. But for this great perfection, just sitting naked awareness, you have to drop the whole thing, drop the whole book, drop the whole conceptual setup, the whole, you know, not just the thoughts within the conceptual setup, but drop the whole conceptual setup just for one moment. That's all you can do anyway. And then it's back. And then, or, you know, ideally you drop it and then before you just, okay, get ready to drop again. That's just picking up the book again. Drop and then just like, the example often given, like you ring the bell is like dropping, and then like as the sound reverberates, that's just this thought-free openness as long as it lasts, maybe half a second. Maybe all day. And then something arises and you drop.
Is Kensho or Satori really in this?
Just offhand, maybe one way I could say it is Kensho means seeing Buddha nature, seeing nature. Short for Buddha nature, which is like, as we know, Buddha nature is like this empty cognizant awareness, seeing that or experiencing that directly. So it may be a little taste of it if you can really drop, which has to do with relaxing completely too. So that's why the subtle body thing we work. It may be that in that one moment, for a half a second, you see nature, but maybe just a tiny, tiny minuscule. As the teacher says, you can have like baby naked awareness. If it's for like a second, as baby naked awareness, but you want to extend this. I think in Zen, Kensho and Rinzai Zen is a little more dramatic. Like you drop, it's not so much the dropping that would be, it's the dropping and then you see, and then that seeing in a way that like, is deep enough that transforms your whole being in a significant way. And one last image for this type of shikantazen. So that's one kind of, again, these are words, but it's a great, when you're sitting zazen, all this stuff's happening, just physically, and you can even bring in physically, drop. And another one, this teacher actually received from his father his first pointing at the nature of mind instructions, which he recounts. Well, as a young boy, his father was a great teacher. He said, "Just you know, look out the window at the vast expanse of sky. But it can be you just look around the room. You know, just that let your peripheral vision just open. Be really open to like." Everything in your field of awareness, and just really relaxed, open, and non-assessing, non-judgmental way in your basically your field of vision. You can bring in the other senses too. You're hearing the siren and all that. Now, sometimes we would say, like, yeah, that sounds like zazen mind itself, but that's not the full story here. You first get used to that. You get used to this. The field of experience basically out there, really relax into that, and then when you're already really settled and really really open with that, then turn the awareness around, and look at that wide open mind that's just as wide and open and boundless, but the one that's actually aware of this wide boundless sphere of experience. It's not so much the wide, that's just a sensory experience, multi-sensory experience. It's now looking back. So in Zen we have these phrases, turn the light of awareness around and shine back, same teaching. But if you expand the sensory world first, then you get this maybe just for a second, you get this really like open, boundless awareness that's taking all of it in with no edges. And that mind, that's like the nature of mind. It has no edges or boundaries. It has no, it's empty of all graspability, has no characteristics, and yet it's like luminously, brightly aware of like all the experience. Every moment we actually have it, right? It's nothing new. It's just, we're usually not so open to it. And that's actually Buddha nature. Yes, last question.
At some point you were talking about Vipassana and Buddha, the wider context, and saying, and we need to remember about emptiness, and if I understood you right, you also said, because we don't want to get caught up in bliss.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a bit of a reaction, which is my problem, but
a non-blissful reaction.
A curiosity of what did you mean? What's wrong with bliss? etc.
Yeah, nothing's wrong with bliss, but if we like kind of fixate on it as some real thing that's not empty, as empty as everything, everything's equally empty, meaning equally ungraspable and fleeting, and if we grasp an experience of bliss, then we'll eventually suffer because it'll end. Or even if it doesn't end, we've already lost. I think probably any experience of true bliss, I think we can just say this, is that all true bliss is non-grasping. Any blissful, even like worldly blissful experiences we have are moments of like, oh, we're not holding on, we're just totally open. So therefore, we kind of are in touch. If bliss is happening, we are in touch with the emptiness of it, I think. But then if we try to get a hold of it, or even by thinking it's something that we can get a hold of, then we lose it. So the union of bliss and emptiness is like another description of Buddha nature. Sometimes we say the union of appearance and emptiness, but a kind of a more fun way to say it, a more blissful way to say it, is the union of bliss and emptiness. Because actually it's when all appearances become blissful. Bliss that can have, that can be really like, have all kinds of problems, you know. It could feel like painful or something, but it's still blissful appearance because it's empty. Adi, adi, adi. So, let's have tea. May all beings realize the union of bliss and emptiness that is their true nature right here and now, circulating through the field of elixir and inside and outside the body throughout space and time. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are exhaustible. I vow to rend them. Karma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.